up and going on, let's go to our legislative update. Ronnie and Kelly, please. He's been spending some long, you got your cots there in the in Madison?
There were some long meetings.
The 3 a.m. vote a couple days ago.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Intergovernmental Relations would like to take this opportunity to thank you for your indulgence in communicating, perhaps sometimes just over the phone as far as developments are concerned at the last minute on the budget. But as the budget was finalized within the past week and a half to 2 weeks in the Assembly and the Senate, it's on its way to the governor. Intergovernmental Relations basically focused in on four major areas of concern: mass transit, family care, child support enforcement, and juvenile justice. While some improvements, there were some improvements that were made to the governor's budget, the remaining areas of family care, mass transit, and juvenile justice. As it relates to child support enforcement, a modification was put forward in the Assembly relative to distribution of revenues and efficiencies, put forward some unclear statutory language that makes it uncertain yet how this is going to play out. Intergovernmental Relations would like to work with Director Lisa Marks to improve, see how we can make improvements in this area, whether it be with working directly with the Department of Children and Families or with the Joint Finance Committee. Specifically, on the first item as it relates to mass transit, on a positive note, there was the removal of the governor's language that would have pulled mass transit away from the segregated transportation fund and put it into the general fund. That was eliminated. So mass transit will remain in the segregated transportation fund. However, as it relates to the big 10% cut that was provided in the governor's budget for the mass transit operating assistance, that remained in the budget. So basically for Milwaukee County, that's about a $7 million reduction in mass transit operating assistance. It is interesting that what did take place was a supplemental appropriation for paratransit, approximately $2.5 million in each year of the biennium was put forward specifically for the paratransit operations statewide. How that plays out specifically under the formulation that's going to be used by the department is still unknown, and that's an item that needs to be resolved as the department finalizes its analysis and determinations of how it will play out. With the reduction of the 7% or the 10% of the $7 million in mass transit, according to Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission, it's projected that a cut of this magnitude would relate to a result of about an 8% service reduction or a 29% fare increase, which both are very, very, very significant to our operations. In a wrap-up motion that took place in Joint Finance, there was the elimination or the disbandment of the CERTA, Southeastern Wisconsin Regional Transportation Authority. Then the question remained as far as the assets of CERTA, which is approximately about $1.3 million. Originally, it was supposed to be divided up one-third, 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 Racine, Kenosha, and Milwaukee. In a wrap-up motion, that was modified so that 50% would be for Milwaukee County, 25% for Racine, and 25% for Kenosha. While that is still not reflective of where the revenues actually come from, that is an improvement given how it originally started. As it relates to general transportation aids, the governor had proposed a 10% cut in GTA. What happened is it worked its way through the legislature and finance committee. There was an improvement to minimize that cut to approximately about 1.7% reduction as opposed to a 10%. However, a lot of that modification was eliminated as it went to the assembly floor. The net result is approximately about a $600,000 improvement with what happened in the legislature versus what was proposed to the governor. Again, that's about $650,000 statewide. How that plays out to Milwaukee County has yet to be determined. Mr. Chairman, do you want me to go section by section on these items for questions, or would you rather?
Well, maybe we can stop at each section and see if there are any questions. Sorry, are you done on transit?
Basically, the summation for transportation.
And if anybody from the audience wants to speak, then tour come up anytime. I would allow that, obviously, too. Any questions or comments on the transit part, Supervisor Bukowski? Sure.
Has the governor actually signed this yet?
No, sir. The budget, as it passed Thursday night, Friday morning. Thursday night.
Okay. Has the Senate voted yet? They have voted.
Right.
Yes.
The Assembly and the Senate has voted, yes.
Yes. Okay. So when is the governor signing it?
Any day now.
Okay.
Basically, the budget's on the governor's desk for his determination of vetoes.
my simple question on mass transit, Mr. Chairman, is we did not get 1 cent as far as help on the $7 million hole that we had?
As it relates to mass transit operating assistance, you're correct. There was no improvement that was made to the reduction, so there would be approximately a $7 million hit more on mass transit.
Wow.
Now, given that there is the supplemental appropriation for paratransit, which is about $5 million over the biennium. I know Jack is here. I'm not sure how that's actually going to play out in the formulation of how much of that we actually receive, but that would be specific for paratransit purposes. It wouldn't help us on our fixed routes, but it would help us in paratransit.
Thank you.
Okay. And one thing, I mean, of course, I don't know how you could have a transit system if, well, I know I went down to State Fair with our staff and some other supervisors, and one area that I talked about was indeed the area of putting mass transit in the general system and taking it out of the segregated fund, because if you took it out of the general, took it out of the segregated fund, then it's in competition with everything else, you know, hospitals, roads, everything else. Yeah, and so I can't imagine what the cut would have been, because you know that our transfer would have been cut if it was outside the segregated fund in competition with so many other great needs, and some we're speaking to today, of course, to family care, child enforcement, et cetera. So it's bad. It could have been even, I can't imagine what it would have been like.
It should be noted that the Joint Finance Committee and the legislature basically held pretty true to the 10% reductions across department lines. So it's not that necessarily the transfer was picked on. Everybody was picked on for that 10% funding.
And we'll have a couple more comments in these areas today, but next month, I mean, you'll be able to work with staff and then to have a report on the final analysis. I mean, the governor's going to, I mean, just pretty much what we're talking about today is going to happen, because unlike when I was county executive here, I certainly don't foresee 35 vetoes or a lot of vetoes coming out of this. Do you foresee any vetoes maybe then?
That'd be very minimal.
Okay.
Very minimal.
Okay. So what we're talking about today is pretty much what it's going to more than likely to be. Other comments, or Supervisor Brumman Broderick? Sure. Okay.
It really is just a comment. I think it's interesting that they put in the additional kind of carrot of the paratransit funding, because paratransit, you know, one of the areas in our mass transit system that we could actually significantly cut if we chose to is paratransit. And so by putting that carrot out there, then what they're really saying is we want your cuts to be in our general bus system daily route operations, or some magical ability to cut the drivers' pay and benefits. The bottom line is they aren't even our drivers, so that's a whole other issue. And we have a particular, even though we don't operate the bus system, there's really only one bus company in town, so they basically have a monopoly. So I really do think that the combination of really many years of no other transit company bidding on this, our services, as well as this budget, pushes the cuts into the operation of the daily bus system. And I think that's really anti-business. I believe our bus routes are the biggest economic development system that Milwaukee County runs directly. You know, we have an economic development office, but it's nothing compared to our bus system. So clearly, it's really attacking folks who of lower income who are trying to get to their jobs. So I think that's inappropriate, and obviously no one on the board supports this. But I think in the end, they're biting off their toes to spite their face, because they need to get workers to those businesses that they say they're going to create, and the new $250,000 new jobs the county executive has promised to create. He won't be able to get the workers to them. Thank you. That's my mini soapbox.
combined with the fact that originally paratransit, as coming out of the governor's office, was not proposed for any cut to begin with, so that
So we'll help the elderly get around, which is great. But it will be now at the expense of working lower income working families. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Bradley.
Thank you. My concerns were along those very same lines. Has there been any conjecture, any study as to the likely impacts that this will have on business, I mean, again, customers and employees getting to and from retail outlets.
Well, specifically, as we mentioned earlier, the Planning Commission has indicated a cut of 10% would equate to approximately 8% reduction in the service area. I know Jack is in the audience relative to any specifics on how this may relate to supervisor or projects.
Was there any, what were the positions of the MMAC and the Greater Milwaukee Committee, if expressed on this issue and its likely impact on the business community?
They did send communications supportive of increasing funds for mass transit operating systems.
So perhaps outstate business interests are favored over local business interests. I don't know what conclusion to draw from that, except that you know, the call used to be get a horse, now apparently it's get a car. Because public transit, I think the death knell is being sounded in every direction.
Thank you. Thank you. You got the Forless Family Care,
right,
which we'll speak to next.
The next topic that we made would be child support enforcement.
Okay.
At the outset, Intergovernmental Relations would like to thank the director and her staff, Lisa Marks and her staff, for spending their time with IGR in Madison. We're working very hard in this effort. We'd like to be able to say there were some accomplishments in this area. Unfortunately, as provided in the governor's budget and what went to the legislature, would have a negative impact on child support enforcement. According to the department, it would face approximately a $3.6 million shortfall in 2012, with a projected loss of approximately 38 positions. As a result, child support enforcement has indicated that approximately 1,680 children will not have paternity established, about 2,500 people will not have support orders in place, and it's estimated that about $18 million in child support collections will be lost, with approximately 24,000 families receiving no support whatsoever. With that information, as I indicated, as IGR indicated earlier, a motion was put forward relative to the distribution of funds and deficiencies for the department. There's some unclear statutory language and uncertainty relative to how that will play out. So we'll be working with the department as time moves forward relative to assisting them, whether it be through the Department of Children and Families or the Joint Finance Committee.
I would just say, and Ms. Marks had a chance. I mean, we talked about this, some of these areas, of course, last month, and she did have a chance to come in front of Health and Human Services and in Finance on Thursday, and I would have to say she was complimentary to you and Ms. Babich on all the work that you've done. And again, another example of going up and trying to advocate for us. And I mean, the governor is well aware of what the cuts would mean. We initially had it in the budget. And then, of course, the new budget then takes out those the full payments we were looking for. It was 4.2, so we lessened the 3.6. Am I hearing that right? Or Ms. Marks, you want to comment on that possibly? Introduce yourself, please. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman, committee members. The amount has not lessened.
Okay.
It's $4.25 million plus the associated matching funds.
That's what I thought I heard first, yeah.
So the $4.2 million can be draw two-thirds federal matching. That makes the total loss about $12 million to the program. Milwaukee County's share of that is $1.2 million plus the associated federal match of $2.4 million, making a grand total for Milwaukee County. If the cuts were allocated across the board, would be $3.6 million. One of the things, thankfully, with the work of IGR that we were able to do very late last week was change some of the language to make it permissive instead of prescriptive as to how the Department of Children and Families can allocate the money, so that the Department of Children and Families will have more of a say-so in how they can allocate the funds out to the counties. Now, once that plan is created, they still have to bring that back before the Joint Finance Committee for a passive review. And the Joint Finance Committee does have the ability to call for a special 1310 hearing to ask for changes or make other recommendations to that amount. But the fact that we were able to at least change the shall to a may to make it permissive instead of prescriptive was a big change.
Thank you. Any other comments, please? Thank you for joining us, Supervisor.
I got a little caught up in the rain there. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry
thank
about that.
Thank you. Okay, anything else from staff? Thank you, Ms. Marks, very much. Keep working. Appreciate it.
The next topic area was related to family care and lifting the caps on the enrollment of family care. Capping the enrollment in this very successful program will increase Medicaid costs for hospitals and nursing homes at the expense of independence, health and well-being of our seniors and disabled individuals. The increase in family care enrollment likely will result in increased medical assistance expenditures for costly nursing home care. Under the proposed enrollment cap, elderly in Milwaukee County will be placed on a waiting list. This is the first time this happened in a decade. Additionally, the 2,000 individuals with disabilities who are already on a waiting list will have to wait even longer. A motion that was adopted in the Finance Committee that would prohibit care management organizations, CMOs, that provide family health care benefits from including in their contracts with providers any provision that would require providers to return funding in excess of the cost of services to the CMO. That was a motion that did pass. Adoption of this type of provision would have a negative impact on the family care operations. Audits are generally used as a means of determining cost effectiveness. Since 2002, the Department of Family Care has recovered approximately $1.7 million in overpayments from corporate providers. As it relates to family care, there was a provision, and we'd like to thank Senator Leah Bucher's office for their help in preventing an adoption of a motion in the Joint Finance Committee that had the potential of costing Milwaukee County family care approximately $5.3 million by requiring case management services to be counted as administrative services. We really want to thank Senator Bucher's staff for assisting us in this area. Maria Ledger also was very instrumental in coming up to Madison and articulating the concerns of family care before the offices of key state legislation. I'd like to thank her for her efforts in this area.
See Ms. Ledger and Ms. Stein in the audience, too. Either of you like to make any comments? Nothing much to say, is there? Okay. Well, we appreciate their advocacy. I hope we've expressed that before. We will today again, too. And the need to stay active and do the best we can in trying circumstances here at this budget, obviously. Okay, thank you for coming, too. Anything else on that, then?
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Supervisor DeBroom, sure.
Thank you. Just on the audit changes, so there will have fewer audits for fraud, misuse, et cetera. Is that the impact?
If we could have Maria.
Yeah. You, Ms. Ledger, you can't get by. We'll get you yet here. Introduce yourself, please, for those listening. Yeah.
Good morning, I'm Maria Ledger. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Department of Family Care. Mr. Chairman, kind of Board Supervisor DeBruin, the audits that the department does of residential providers is an annual process to look at when the department sets a rate for a provider, it's based on certain assumptions in terms of staffing and occupancy. If those assumptions don't hold to be true, say, for instance, a provider has not been able to fill their beds, like a residential provider, or in some cases, residential providers have made conscious decisions not to fill their beds with all family care individuals, but have had some individuals who are private pay. So when the audit process will go back and look at, Mr. De La Rosa said, the cost effectiveness, but also how the dollars that were paid to that provider were expended. And so if there was a provider that had filled fewer of their beds, didn't staff up, and then if in that instance that there was an overpayment, then the provision is that those overpayments come back in and go back to the Medicaid program. So those are audits that we do on an annual basis and then look at whether there's any potential for recoupment. So as RGR staff pointed out, it's been over $1.7 million since 2002. It was characterized at the Capitol as a punitive measure for when providers are cost effective, but that is, it's not what this is. This is looking at whether the rates that were determined and with the budgets that they were established upon hold true for the year of service that provider was providing care to family care members.
So will you have an ability to I mean, one of the obviously my biggest concern here is this is a privatized system, I get it, mm-hmm. but you have to monitor the amount of fraud that the state has put up mm-hmm. with in all sorts of the systems in health mm-hmm. and human services has been phenomenal, and it just amazes me that they're going to go in and deliberately remove a primary mechanism to catch either mistakes mm-hmm. or misuse or mm-hmm. Or at deliberate fraud. Mm-hmm. What mechanism is left for anyone to go in and make sure that the funds are appropriately spent?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't, Mr. Chair and County Board Supervisor DeBruin, we are still able to request those audits, and there are other managed care organizations that do. What this prevents is then the repayment of overpayments. But we can still use those audits,
okay.
and other MCOs use them for the same purpose, to look at the operations of their providers to make sure that all the services that should be provided have been provided and have been provided in the way that we contracted for. What it prevents, though, is the repayment of overpayments.
So we can find out if they're still committing
right.
fraud or misuse, but if a provider does that, they don't have to pay mm-hmm. us back.
Mr. Chair, County Board Supervisor, it's not necessarily fraud when there's an overpayment. Again,
I understand.
So
misuse
or underutilization
of the
of the service. So if an overpayment would be appropriate, this prevents us from putting language in our contracts that allows us to bring that back in.
But playing catch up and retroactively is always worse.
Mm-hmm.
Than proactively having language in the initial contract.
Mm-hmm.
It weakens the ability of the sponsor, in this
mm-hmm.
case the county or
mm-hmm.
the state, in other cases, from
mm-hmm.
being able to effectively monitor those stuff. Okay,
I
know we're preaching to the choir, but it's
yeah.
like there's an assault within this entire budget, almost in every major system, that
mm-hmm.
is removing accountability mm-hmm. from private service providers. And I just don't understand when it's going to end. Thank you.
You're welcome. Supervisor Broderick?
That's what's meant by being business friendly.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair. You're welcome.
And Plato speaks.
Supervisor DeBruin, sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
as you were going around speaking with, I believe you, I thought you were at the Capitol a few
mm-hmm.
times too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not asking you to defend any of those positions, but I think for the listening audience,
mm-hmm.
what are some of the reasons, because I've only seen some kind of ridiculous types of comments in the paper, that people actually think that this cap would be a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
What were you hearing as you were, traveling around and mentioning that this would be extremely harmful?
Mr. Chairman, Supervisor Dmitrievich, I heard a number of things as Ms. Babich and Mr. De La Rosa did. The comments ranged from a lack of understanding of the original basis for the program. One individual thought that perhaps the reason that one of the legislative staffers thought that perhaps the reason the legislature was so concerned was because the program had started solely to serve older adults. And when I pointed out that that wasn't the case, that in every other managed care organization from the pilot stage forward, it was all target populations, people with physical and developmental disabilities and frail elders, they were surprised to hear that. And I've heard that from more than one person. So I don't know if the Department of Health Services hasn't done or because there's been turnover in terms of the legislature, but there seems to be sort of an imperfect understanding of what the program is, who it serves, and what its what its mission is. I mean, the mission was to slow the growth of the rate of Medicaid dollars, which it's done, and to promote people's ability to live independently and safely in the community, which, again, it has done. There was also a focus on the fact that the costs have grown within the program without tying it exactly to the fact that because it's serving more people, and it's serving more people who would have otherwise used Medicaid dollars in an unmanaged way, and probably at a greater expense. So I think it's just the legislature perhaps was hoping for a higher level of specificity from their legislative audit bureau report, but I think the LAB did an excellent job in trying to articulate, because I think what people assumed was the point of that LAB was audit was not really wasn't in the mission that they were given when they started out on it. So there's a lot of different reasons. There just seems to be, and what I keep hearing falling back on is that there are problems within the program. They can't articulate what they are. They want time to figure out what those problems are. There was another statement that perhaps there had always been problems and now they have come to light, but it just seems to be a fairly murky proposition depending upon who you talk to.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, the failure to really understand this is what's been the most present to me, because I think if you summarize some of your comments in 3 points, in fact, we have saved money, and at the same time, we've really improved the quality of life. And you can't just look at the program costs are going slightly up because it's a great thing that you're serving more people, and the idea was to get people off the wait list. But when you put it in context, you're saving money, which apparently this budget is trying to do, on decreasing Medicaid and institutionalizing. Mm-hmm. That was the whole reason. Mm-hmm. And the last thing that I wanted to mention, if you could too, especially for those who are listening, is on the wait list component. So now we had all those thresholds that were built in and we were promised. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is basically, this budget to me is a budget of broken promises. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. But more so, I want to talk about those broken promises and what that means for people in Milwaukee County who've been on the wait list, for, to my knowledge, over 10 years. Mm-hmm. So now with this cap, could you maybe quickly just summarize what it would mean to those individuals who, that's why it's a broken promise. Mm-hmm. They've been waiting. Mm-hmm. They were told that they were not going to have to wait anymore, so we could be like other counties in the state. Mm-hmm. And now, once again, we're dealing with this. So what does that actually come out to be then?
With the existing wait list right now of some 2,000 people between 18 and 59 with physical and developmental disabilities, and July 1st, there will be a brand new wait list of older adults, which hadn't ever existed since 2002. What the caps mean is that if they take a snapshot of what the enrollment is for all of long-term care services in Milwaukee County, so they will look at the number of people in family care, in IRIS, and the PACE and partnership programs. And if you say, for the sake of argument, that's 10,000 people, that's your number. Mm-hmm. And so if someone disenrolls from Milwaukee County Department of Family Care, that means there's a spot, but it doesn't necessarily mean that spot is coming back to the Milwaukee County Department of Family Care. There may be a new enrollment into IRIS or into the other managed care organization or into the PACE and partnership programs, but it's going to somehow there's going to have to be that one for one, so we always stay at that number. The people that are accepted from that are people who are relocating from nursing homes, and the Department of Health Services has made available 400 emergency slots statewide. And it is the department's discretion in terms of what constitutes an emergency. So if that's going to be individuals whose caregivers are no longer able to care for them, someone who's in a legal crisis, whatever that means. But those are for the entire state of Wisconsin. So in order for someone to come in off of that wait list, there has to be someone who leaves, and then there's going to have to be a decision on the part, I'm assuming, of the two resource centers in Milwaukee County of, again, is that going to be someone who has been waiting for 10 years for services or someone who is 85 years old? Who is in the best position to wait for services? Someone for whom, you know, the two-year biennium is a life sentence when you're 85 years old, or someone who has already been waiting this long? It is nothing but a choice between bad choices.
That's so sad. That's very disturbing. I can't even talk anymore, so thank you.
Can you introduce yourself? You want to comment on this question or something related? Introduce yourself, please, for those listening.
I am Stephanie Stein. I'm the director of the Department on Aging. If I can, I'd like to comment on two of Supervisor Dmitrievich's questions. The first is, what are people saying? It is really irrelevant what people are saying. This is a lockstep vote. The budget says that there's a cap on family care until they look at the audit, because they have to know what's going on. The audit came out. It says absolutely nothing that would prevent family care from moving on. Nothing. And as a matter of fact, Secretary Smith of the Department of Health Services said to us who sit on the Long-Term Care Council, we cannot dwell on that audit. Let's just forget that audit. So the reason that they were capping family care no longer exists. The real reason for the cap in family care and everything else that's happening in the Medicaid budget is Secretary Smith has an agenda, and that agenda is going to be carried out. He doesn't like family care. He doesn't like PACER partnership. He doesn't like any of those programs. And so you will see now an evolution of something very different than exists now in Wisconsin. The waiting list, right now there are between 400 and 500 older people in the process of applying for family care. So they've had a functional screen, but they're not eligible for Medicaid yet. They will be in 2 months when they spend all their money. They have to find some papers to get in to determine their Medicaid eligibility. Their family's making a decision about what would be best, et cetera. As of today, none of those people in the pipeline are going to make it through the system unless they're already on SSI or Medicaid. There's no way they will make it through economic support by July 1st. So on July 1st, there will be between 400 and 500 older people who will be told you do not have services, and placed on a waiting list. We're still not sure how, from the day they called or how close they are to completion, or when their Medicaid papers are actually done. This is going to be a very tough call in just establishing the waiting list for those 400 or 500 people and then adding another 150 people a month to that list. So the whole situation is going to be horrible, and the worst part is that people are going to blame us. They're going to blame our departments, and they're going to blame you, because we're here. We're here. We're the people who talked to them about programs. We're the people who did the outreach. We're the people who bragged about how wonderful this was. And now our human service workers are going to have to be telling people there is no more guaranteed benefit. Now, by all determination, almost all of the people who leave family care, the disenrollments, are older people, because most of the disenrollments are due to death. And a few are people who move or people who become ineligible because they get a lot of money. That's very few people. But clearly, in the spirit of cooperation, it would not be fair to people with disabilities who have been waiting for 10 years only to take older people off the waiting list. So Director Lyde and I are in the process of looking at the most fair way of operating this, whether it's 50-50, whether it's 60-40, we're not sure yet. But we'll let you know as soon as we figure out the best way to do that. But people in this community are in for a very rude awakening, because there will be no help. And so if there's 400 or 500 people and we can serve maybe 100 people a month, maybe, we're going to have waiting lists of over a year for older people very, very soon.
Are you done, Supervisor?
Thank you.
Okay. Supervisor Brodman?
This seems to be forcing the rationing of care. There aren't death panels attached to this, are there, that we could attribute to the Republican administration and State House in Madison? Because the criticisms that were leveled at Obamacare were about rationing care by this philosophical group. Now they're actually employing the rationing of care against all their outcries. And, you know, that's curious. But, of course, other than an opinion column here and there, I'm sure we're not going to have much impact on this juggernaut that is renting the progressive history of this state. What a tragedy.
Supervisor DeBrone?
Question. On the roughly 2,000 or so persons with disabilities who are already on the waiting list and have been for many years, just briefly describe how that's different from across the state again.
A lot of different managed care organizations are at different stages of entitlement. So because expansion in Milwaukee County for persons with disabilities, people 18 to 59, started in November of 2009, the projection was that that would take time to get to that entitlement stage as we worked through rolling over people on the Medicaid waivers as well as taking a portion of individuals on the wait list. In Milwaukee County, for that first year of expansion, the first year that we began to serve younger people, the initial policy of the Department of Health Services was that it would just be those people who are currently receiving services through the Medicaid waivers, that we wouldn't take anyone off of the wait list that first year. There was a great deal of advocacy both by disability advocates and by aging advocates, and so we were allowed to take a very small portion of people off of the wait list. So that's the essential, that's the big difference between how this county rolled out expansion as opposed to other counties throughout Wisconsin. So had Milwaukee been able to attack that wait list in earnest that first year, we very likely would not be having this conversation right now about the 2,000 people who are still waiting for services. But instead of over 100, there was a handful, perhaps 10 to 15 each month. So because we were only able to take a smaller number, that larger number still exists. And that smaller number was a number established by the Department of Health Services, because when you bring someone in off of the wait list, that's someone who hasn't already been receiving services.
I guess this is more now a question than of Director Stein, and, and I may be reacting differently than you, and you're welcome to disagree, but it seems that we're getting to a point in some of these programs where it's almost discrimination by bureaucracy and by geography. If you live in Milwaukee County, you aren't going to get these services, or you're going to have to wait 10, 15 plus years. And there comes a point where that you can't say that that's not deliberate. And you, and fairly soon, we might end up seeing some lawsuits here. Because if you are disabled in Milwaukee County and can't get services, but you can get that same service in another county, and you can go back from years of state decisions that have delayed your services being even available for you to get in Milwaukee County. I just think they're treading down a very serious path, and bureaucracy, you know, people don't notice it, but it really, to me, it's discrimination by bureaucracy and by geography, and I'm getting to the point where even as a responsible elected official, I no longer... I'm starting to believe that it's deliberate, and I guess I'm hoping you'll comment on that. If I'm way off base, I'd like to hear that, and I respect your opinion.
I'd like to just step back a minute and remind everyone that Milwaukee County wasn't even in the state expansion budget. Our then county executive lobbied with the Department of Health Services to put Milwaukee County 2 years ahead in expansion. and got, and with the support of this board. So the person who's now responsible for these caps is the person that started this promise, or at least began the discussion of this promise in Milwaukee County. I can tell you that senior law is asking older people who are now in the process of getting on family care to contact them, because they believe that once you apply for a Medicaid service and that Medicaid service is available, which it is today, if we could get them on, it is available today, that they have an entitlement to that service. So they are very interested in bringing case-by-case cases on people who are on the waiting list, who are trying to get on today before July 1st. And that's a lot of people. Now, they have already had several cases like that in the past, and they've won every one of them because the department withdrew. And the reason the department withdrew is because they do not want a ruling on this. So every time legal action takes them to court, they give up. They stop. Senior law cannot bring class action lawsuits, right, but Disability Rights Wisconsin can. And they're discussing with them the rights of people with disabilities being violated, especially in Milwaukee County. Especially in Milwaukee County. Because, you know, some counties never had waiting lists in the first place. So if someone dies, the next person who calls up will get a slot. That will not be, our waiting lists are simply going to grow and grow.
Last question,
sure.
Mr. Chair, does Milwaukee County have any ability to say, for example, or to decide to throw millions of dollars of new taxes in the program and fund it and get rid of those waiting lists, or is this truly something that we couldn't change even if we had the money to change it?
Chairman Schmidt, Supervisor, we could not do that. The law right now says the program will be capped. So no more slots can be used whether there's other money or not.
Well, that is an important point to make, that even if Milwaukee County had independently millions upon millions of dollars to eradicate all the waiting lists, we would not be allowed to by the state.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Family care.
As your age to do justice is the next component on the budget.
Thank you.
The basically as it relates to juvenile justice, the question of youth aid cuts and the daily rate increases. The 10% proposed cut that was in the governor's budget was maintained through the legislative process. And keeping in mind that this will have an impact on the current budget, the current fiscal year of the county. So in other words, we'll be reduced anticipated reduction in youth aid of about $1.8 million this year and approximately $3.6 million next year. There was the recommendation to close the Southern Oaks Girls Center in Racine and Ethan Allen in Waukesha. However, given that there was still the increase in the daily rates that were provided initially, those were maintained. I'd like to say that since at the outset, when there was an indication of the closing of the two facilities of Racine and and in Waukesha, we worked closely with the Milwaukee County Court Delinquency and Court Support Services Division, as well as with Racine County, to secure legislation consistent with Chairman Holloway's provision, a resolution that would extend the time in which juveniles could be held in a detention center from 30 to 60 days. That communication was also reflective to sponsors out of the Racine area, and letters of support along those lines have been communicated. And while that resolves the issues of the four main areas that have been topics of discussion for the past week and a half to 2 weeks, there's also an area that we'd like to, a couple of other areas we'd like to talk about briefly, one of which is courts. As we've all indicated for some time now, there's a disproportionate share of property tax that continues to pay for the state-funded court system. to a certain extent, what happened in the legislature was a situation where small claims court, which currently is capped at a jurisdictional limit of $5,000, and the budget was increased up to $10,000. IGR had indicated this is an unfunded mandate, and quite frankly had proposed this be reduced or be eliminated from the proposed budget. There was an author of a bill that would provide some degree of revenues for small claims who also indicated to have this removed from the budget. We have communications from Clerk John Barrett requesting that the provision in the budget be vetoed by the governor. One other area in the area, of course, we'd like to talk about that had some degree of positive results, and that was namely the Milwaukee County TAD program, the Treatment Alternatives and Diversions Program. Through the efforts of Senator Darling, approximately $333,000 for each year for a grant to Milwaukee County for TAD was initiated and was approved and goes forward to the governor. And along those lines, I'd like to thank the Chief Judge Kramish for his ability to be able to communicate the concerns to the legislature, and at this point has resulted in some degree of success. I know Mr. Barrett's in the audience. I know if you wanted to have any discussion relative to this.
Sure. Thank you. Might introduce yourselves and those listening.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Barrett. I'm the Clerk of Circuit Court for Milwaukee County.
I'm Jim Smith, Chief Deputy Clerk. Good morning.
I'd like to go over, I know Roy has talked about some of them, but I would like to go over about 5 points with regard to legislation that's going on in Madison right now. The five issues are small claims, bail bondsmen, the loss of funding for child support enforcement, the court services, support services reduction for the courts, and the concealed carry bill. The small claims reduction, I know that Roy mentioned that it's essentially an unfunded mandate. There are two parallel pieces of legislation going on right now. There is a provision in the budget bill which increases the small claims limit from $5,000 to $10,000. It creates exceptions for some personal injury and some other tort cases, which we believe will create confusion and problems in the courts. That an individual who brings a lawsuit, then someone says, well, this is a small claim or other, that case then, if it goes into one of the categories that are the exceptions, the court will have to dismiss that matter. And then the individual will have to refile it in the large claims area. So for litigants themselves, this bill in the budget, we believe, will cause confusion and problems, not to mention the fact that the small claims courts right now have processed about 45,000 cases already. What this does is this shifts additional cases to that area from judges, which are paid for by the state, to small claims, which are essentially court commissioner courts, which are paid for by the county. So all of this additional work and resources will be shifted from the state to the county with regard to covering these cases. The AB 106 bill, which is the parallel legislation, does some of the same things. It increases the jurisdictional limit from $5,000 to $10,000, but it doesn't have a lot of these exceptions. What it does is it also provides additional resources to the counties to the tune of $22 for every case filed in Milwaukee County. So it would provide significant amount of resources to the county to handle this increase in work. And so our preference clearly is from one that creates confusion and problems to one that, while it may be somewhat problematic in increasing additional work, it does provide us with resources to handle that work. With regard to the bail bondsman issue, we feel that this will also impact us budgetarily. That currently we have the process works is that a judge will set bail, and if an individual fails to appear, that bail is then forfeited. That forfeited bail comes to us at the county and is used partially to fund our court system. What the bail bond bill does is it creates almost a shift of that money going to the bail bonds. Those resources, the bail bondsmen would only have to post 10% of the bail. And then in other states, they found that the bail bonds people generally default on the guarantee to the county. So you end up with a person who doesn't, you know, right now they have an interest in coming back to court because a judge can give them their bail back. Right now, if they pay the money, if they pay money to a bail bondsman, that's non-refundable. There's no interest in coming back to court, and the money is never going back to them or to the county. It's going to the bail bondsman. So that to me is problematic, and in addition to the fact that we're going to create a whole industry of Dog the Bounty Hunters all over the place, and we are then going to be the collection agent to collect from these various bail bondsmen who we then don't have the resources to go out and get money from these bail bonds people. Thirdly,
could we question as we go?
Sure.
On that,
if you'd like, sure.
It's not my
turn. The history of the bail. I mean, what we're doing in reality is reverting, if I understand it correctly, to a previous system that was reformed or was abandoned because of its impacts, many of which you mentioned. But there was the constant threat of it corrupting the judicial system itself. Could you talk? It's important to understand that I think that this is a return to what was viewed as a very bad practice. But of course, bail bondsmen are businessmen. I have to point that out. And this is good for business, perhaps, but it's very bad for government, and it's very bad for the representatives of a democratic and representative point of view regarding government. The question is the historical precedent that we're now reverting to. Can you comment on that?
I believe that the reform was done in 1979, and that what's been in place now, the current system has been in place since that time, and this is in fact correcting a problem that no one is complaining about except for the bail bonds people who have a profit motive. I don't have anything against the profit motive, although what I think is problematic is when you tie the profit motive in with justice. I think that is unhealthy, and I just don't think that we should be doing that. And I think that the system that as it exists right now is one in which there's an incentive for an individual to come back to court and to resolve these matters, and to not necessarily create churning of cases within the system. If we have to perpetually come back and do these over and over again, it creates additional paperwork that's unnecessary, and we really don't think it's good for the court system.
I would just comment that I have nothing against profit either, but privatization essentially is building a profit motive in to something that perhaps has been operating well, as in this case and so many other cases in government, operating well. And the claim is that by building in a profit motive, we create efficiencies. We've seen this fail time and time and time again. And nonetheless, people continue to cleave to this concept that what is private and managed privately is a better thing, and particularly if it involves a profit, whereas government has been providing many of these services, in this case since 1979, With no profit motive and no need to put one in, it seems to me to be a corruption of current practice that has proven itself to be efficient to add something like this. And if that's privatization, or if it's adding an unnecessary profit motive, then I think there's reason to question it.
If I may?
Sure.
There's another aspect to this which I think is underreported and is critically important for you to have the knowledge of it, and that's the second victimization of victims. Frequently, bail money is used to reimburse victims for issues related to whatever they've been a victim of. If we take that money out of the system, the money that's used to pay victims back will no longer be there. And that, to me, is troublesome. I think that we have an obligation, and I believe it's even in the Constitution, to take care of our victims. And this takes away the resources for us to do that. And I think that that's troubling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not trying to make light of the situation because this is really difficult, but I'll propose a rhetorical question. Probably a page out of my colleague's book. Maybe this is actually the only thing I've seen in the budget that deals with our job creations. Maybe this is kind of a failed attempt at job creation here. I mean, it's not funny, but I'm just bringing up how horrible this is, that it double victimizes people. And I mean, you look at these situations, and I've had constituents come to me, and that's why I'm asking these questions with family care too. Like, who's winning? We're talking about all the people who are losing. You know, the victims are losing, but who's winning? This random group of bail bondsmen that we've never had before? I mean, this is like outrageous. I just don't get it. It's totally perplexed. I mean, but yeah, and to go back in some ancient form of dealing with justice that doesn't even work is more costly and takes restitution away. At, you know, what gets 50 guys a job? Well, there, are you already any closer to your 250,000, whatever the heck it is? You know, I'm not asking anybody this. I'm just giving an opinion because I'm elected to do so. So thank you very much.
Thank you. You are.
If I may continue.
Well, I just had a quick follow-up. I mean, you were talking about the history and the big bail about for reasons that show, and the difficulty of, you can have so many people. Is there a special license for somebody you have to apply for? I presume for bail bondsmen, but then how do you keep track? And it would be our responsibility to go after the bail bondsmen to get our money, and that seems to be is going to be a very difficult process to say the least. Also, correct?
Yes, you hit it right on the head, and that to me is something that is a troubling aspect of this legislation, and frequently it's the case that the bail bonds people, you know, it's just anecdotal, but you know that they essentially will you know not pay when they have an obligation to do so, and that's obviously troublesome.
Just two requests for some follow-up information. If you don't have it now, I'd appreciate just sending it to me later.
Or all of us.
I was just assuming that you'd all want it. But the first was that I'd like to have some sort of estimate as to the fiscal impact of maybe a projected fiscal impact of this, as far as the amount of money that we are currently receiving from this that will now go to the bail bondsman, and in particular, the amount of money that is given to or reimbursed to victims of crime that will no longer have a funding source for. I don't know whether that's $100,000 a year or what that level is, and I agree with all the comments before, but the other supervisors made, but I'm particularly concerned about the second victimization of victims. I remember Walker campaigned on some of those issues as supporting victims and victims' rights, and was furious when there were some concerns that he hadn't been supportive enough, and then sure enough, this budget goes in and does this. And I just want to get some clear understanding as to
the level of that funding loss. Do you have those figures now? Or
I don't have them on the top of my head, but we'll research that. And I'm not even sure that it's easily obtainable, but we'll look and see what we can provide to you.
Okay. And then my other question is, and maybe this is very naive because I don't know this the industry very well, but will the concealed carry laws have any impact on this? Will more bail bondsmen be? Can they carry guns now? Are they kind of the bounty hunter system? Is that allowed currently, or would that the new laws impact this?
I personally am not aware of a connection other than their ability to carry the concealed weapon. But I do have concealed carry as one of my concerns legislatively, just in the impact of our office with respect to some computer functions that don't exist right now, that likely will exist in a year from now. But there are obligations in this bill with regard to our office reporting individuals with mental health issues, with issues relating to restraining orders, with issues relating to criminal backgrounds, that we have to research and provide that information to individuals without any additional resources to do so, and without a computer program in place to do it. And so that is something that is on that level concerning to our office with regard to another additional amount of work without any additional resources. In fact, we are looking at far less resources. The other aspect is the court support services reduction, which aligns with the 10% reduction everywhere else. So we get a 10% cut in our court support services fee, which amounts to between $400,000 and $500,000. So we have a cut there. The cut in child support enforcement, which to me is baffling, since that there's a federal government match, and in the federal government match we cross charge child support enforcement for some of the services that we provide to them, including court commissioners. And in doing so, she submits those bills to the federal government, and the federal government reimburses us at a two-thirds level. When they cut the resources from child support, they're cutting the resources to us. So we have, in this year's budget, added a court commissioner back, fully on the backs of the county, that was previously paid for two-thirds by the federal government. It's baffling to me that they would do that. So that's basically the extent of my concerns. We have the small claims concern, we have the bail bondsman's, the loss of the commissioner due to the reduction of child support funding. We have a court support service reduction of 10% and the concealed carry. So our revenues are going to be down and our work is going to be way up. It's a crazy world in which we live in. I'm a Shiganavel.
I noticed you sent kind of a summarization of what you just talked about, the heavy caseload and small claims already, which would just dramatically go up and go from 5,000 to 10,000. And of course, now instead of a state responsibility, it becomes more of our responsibility on our tax rolls. So, and then there's the state and then the bail bondsman. But this is all, this is why I need to write the governor, and then we need to petition the governor, because he'll be the one in. Back to Vito, as we said, they're probably pretty small, but we want to make sure that this is. And you just sent this, summarizing these facts. It's the today.
Yeah, well, it was.
Sent the 17th.
Yeah, we were hoping and hopeful that
it wasn't going to be in the bill to start with.
Right, and so I think we found out, you know, that it's despite the efforts for transparency in government, it was very hard to find information out regarding any of these bills, and so the transparency in government is about as clear as mud.
I think this was talked about, whether you know pros and cons, but it definitely is in the bill, bail bonds going to the governor.
Okay. Mr. De La Rosa?
Surely.
That
is in the your question. Go ahead.
Just in general, has the governor indicated any receptivity to, or any indication that you might veto, considering that the legislature virtually, I mean, they did make some changes, but in essence it's his package. Are you assuming that he probably will sign it intact, or are people expecting there might be some changes?
If there are any changes, I don't think of any major changes. If so, I think any changes are minimal.
So the likelihood of vetoing in provisions or out provisions that cost or that would cost the state more money at this point, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the virtually everything we heard today, the chances are virtually no, that they would be corrected at this point in time. Okay, thank you, I guess.
Coming on the topic of concealed carry, only because that was going to be an item that was going to raise later.
Okay.
But in light of the communications or the actions taken by this committee at its last meeting imposing concealed carry, and the fact
thank
that
you.
Once the county board approved that, they immediately transferred the resolution to the policymakers. The remaining questions are relative to the zoo, parkland, and buses. I'd like to thank Supervisor Roger for his efforts in communicating those concerns to the legislature. The concealed carry has passed the Senate and is scheduled to be on the Assembly floor tomorrow. Special order business for the Assembly floor for tomorrow.
Have there been modifications?
Sure.
There?
Yeah.
Originally,
the governor was changing his ideas.
Originally, the Senate version has been changed to include permitting, licensing, background checks in relationship to this. And the concerns that have been raised relative to the zoo seems to indicate that we can be posting notifications of signage on the facilities on the grounds of the zoo, but the grounds themselves may be areas for concealed carry could still be implemented, as well as in the parking lot. As you know, in the parkland area, a facility on a parkland area could be, our understanding is that it could be, signage could be posted, but yet people could still carry the concealed carry onto the grounds themselves. Subsequently, the nature of your questions that are posed in the letter to legislators, so those are still outstanding.
Yeah, Mr. Chair?
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, when we discovered, and I appreciate it being pointed out, that you could walk into a bar armed, but were prohibited from drinking. However, if you wanted to take a bottle of tequila and an Uzi to a local park, that was perfectly acceptable, which I think is an indication of how carefully thought through this whole piece of legislation was. And the costs that are going to be imposed on the county, as Clerk Barrett pointed out, are small when compared to the potential human costs that we're all going to have to bear witness to. How a civilized society proceeds in this fashion is just hard to understand. This Wild West kind of mentality, and my impression was that we paid taxes as dues to belong to a civilized society. I don't think the public, in its wisdom, decided to reverse that. I think a small group of radicals who were given license to do this by an electorate who spends too much time watching reality television is responsible, and I think there's a great deal of remorse. I certainly hope there's a great deal of remorse, and I certainly hope that remorse is expressed loudly on both July 12th and August 9th.
As it relates to concealed carry, if I may, there was a provision relative to special events. While I think that was initially intended to prohibit concealed carry onto special events such as Summerfest or State Fair, the way the language is written, some have interpreted that maybe application relative to situations, say, at the zoo, where virtually every weekend there is a special event, could have some implementation. But that's a question of implementation which has to be resolved.
Supervisor DeBrone, thank you.
A follow-up request, perhaps with Corporation Counsel, taking the primary lead on it, but also assistance from Intergovernmental. I think we need to have in writing an interpretation of what this statute, once it's fully in place what this statute's operational implications are for Milwaukee County, what we can and can't do with signage, with outdoor access, and I would request that that be a follow-up report from Corporation Council, primarily.
Good idea.
They would be looking at it when the bill is signed by the governor, then anyway.
Because I think as specific as possible. In other words, you know, what are our rights, what are our responsibilities under that, and particularly both from a facility viewpoint. It's not just the facility of the zoo, it's the courthouse, it's the Performing Arts Center, it's all of that, but then also our lands, which are public lands that we own, but they're still considered public, and what the differences might be. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Supervisor. Is that your report?
The very last item I'd like to talk about briefly relates to income maintenance redesign. There's communication shared by the County Board Chairman Holloway to members of the County Board back on June 10th, related to his letter to Secretary Dennis Smith from the Department of Health Services about the actions taken at the Joint Finance Committee relating to the reconfiguration of income maintenance centralization redesign. Currently, there's about 171 individuals, full-time individuals, Milwaukee-Fine employees, who perform income maintenance services that are contracted to the state. The motion that was adopted in the legislature would, quote, direct Health and Human Services to replace those county positions with state positions. In his communications, the chairman notes that Milwaukee County would have to support ongoing legacy costs associated with those employees and the reconfiguration. I'd like to call that to your attention because that's a potentially a big issue that has yet to be resolved. Part of the motion that took place was that the department was to meet with Milwaukee County within 30 days after the effectiveness of the signage of the bill so that communications could take place relative to items such as these, as well as implementation timeline, whether there was going to be a probationary period, whether they're going to be using space at the COG Center or not. Some of those other issues have also yet to be discussed and resolved. It should be taking place. Okay.
Anything else? Go ahead. Or, okay,
oh, I just, Mr. Chairman, I didn't know. It seemed like we were getting ready to adjourn, and before
right.
we do that,
sure.
I want to make sure that if the committee will allow me to be added voting aye, so it would be 5-0 on item number 1.
Okay. Objection so noted. And Mr. DeRosa and Ms. Bellows are very solicitous. I'm getting phone calls from all the time letting me know what's going on and try to pass on, but you know, this report is necessary. Then when the governor should be signing this bill, I mean, the assembly in the one area is still talking, as you mentioned. And then the ramifications, besides and working with staff. So, as much as possible, we can get a summary. And we've asked for some summaries already and some implications and costs that the supervisor will ask staff. So, we'll get that on.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Katie will help us follow up on that, then, too, please. Yes, sir.
We have discussions with Ross to work together in formulating for purposes of a summation document, similar to what was compiled initially at the outset to begin. Coordination with that.
Tell me we expect that in bank and forth.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yes.
On that, I was going to ask apparently for the Finance Committee, but I also think it would be appropriate for this committee as well that we have a follow-up report on the estimated impact fiscally to Milwaukee County from all of these budgetary changes. And obviously that and the sooner the better, but at the same time, you also want good data as well. And obviously, we have to have that before budget, but I do think it would be important to not just have it individually kind of kept in separate departments. A culmination document, I think, would be important to really get the broad picture. And hopefully, I was going to speak to the chair of the Finance Committee as well about that, but hopefully both committees would take a look at that impact, because I think it'd be helpful for not only us but our constituents and as well as the state folks to know that impact as well.
It's nice to have Mr. Katie here from Finance
yep.
too. So
Mr. Chairman, right. We'll need that. Mr. Cady, thank you. The previous document also tried to capture some of the fiscal tools that would be available under the budget repair bill or Act 10, which is pending. And so the next document, again, will give you a sort of one-stop shopping on the budget cuts and the other savings that might be available.
Great.
Thank you. Okay. All right, thank you very much.